This week on Bloodstream, Amy and I are talking about upcoming COVID-19 vaccines and one key piece of information that my gene therapy anxious blood brothers are gonna wanna keep in mind.
Speaking of gene therapy, last week, the World Federation of Hemophilia hosted a panel titled Gene Therapy: Is Robust Scientific Inquiry the Missing Factor? Which Patrick attended and we'll talk about.
I attended at 7 a.m. on a Friday, no less, because I'm a dork. And
correct.
Yes, there's all of that. Plus, Amy and I talk state-level advocacy with National Hemophilia Foundation's Senior Manager of Government Relations, Bill Roby, and the returning champion himself, VP of Public Policy, Nathan Schaefer.
We will never put you in a position, community member, in a really terrible position where you're set up to fail. We'll never do that.
Don't ever let the intimidation reserve you from going and showing up.
I'm your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm your other host, Amy Board.
We are not doctors, so make sure you do talk to medical professionals before making any healthcare decisions.
But we are passionate advocates committed to delivering the best podcast we can to the bleeding disorders community.
So thank you for listening. Subscribe and tell a friend. And hey, welcome to Bloodstream. Really looking forward to sharing that conversation with Nathan and Bill. Some important COVID and gene therapy related topics to discuss as well. And Amy, I want to chat about another podcast that I listened to this morning. Actually, two podcasts that I listened to this morning with patients talking about their experience of blood disorders from the patient perspective, and one in particular in such a thoughtful and deeply resonant way for me.
And so you haven't mentioned this to me before, so I am dying to hear what you have to say. I can't wait.
I just came on and was like, Amy, we got to talk about other podcasts. And you were like, oh,
I know,
okay,
listeners,
record.
I don't know what he's going to say either. This is going to be great.
But I just want to start out by letting all of our listeners know that this episode of the Bloodstream podcast was made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. And Takeda's got this website, bleedingdisorders.com. And that's where you can go to learn all about Takeda's commitment to and resources for the bleeding disorders community, including their Hello Factor magazine, which you can download and read about other patients' stories of life with a bleeding disorder. They each only have the one bleeding disorder. Oh, I guess you could have multiple bleeding disorders. The peaks and the troughs. Haha. Once again, you'll find Hello Factor and more from Takeda at bleedingdisorders.com. And for their ongoing support of the Bloodstream podcast, I would just like to say thanks, Takeda. All right, Ms. Board. All right, so I'm anxious to speak with you this morning, obviously, but I do want to first do my job of saying good morning, Amy, and how are you?
Oh, I'm well, and I'm so glad you asked. This is a huge week for me, being a huge Swiftie. It's Taylor Swift week. She released a new album out of the blue. She created chaos. It was insane. It's been great, but like it's been heightened. It's like a heightened Taylor Swift week in my house. Not only did she release a new album, but her first album that she released this year in like August or whatever, I finally got the vinyl last night. Like it finally came.
I was just about to ask because I know you've been waiting on that. So last night was the night, huh?
It was actually, yes. And this is the first time I've told the story and it's hilarious. So Rob, my boyfriend, comes in and I was making dinner and like furiously making dinner. It was, you know, like timing and everything. So I was like running around and he comes in with this package and he's like, do you know what this is? And I was like, is that the Christmas? And I was like, open it. Cause you know, I couldn't open it. And he opens it and I swear to God, Patrick, he gets the vinyl and confetti comes out. I swear to God, she's magic. And we both just screamed. Like Rob was so horrified. I mean, literally like
because of
stars
all the confetti on the floor
and moons, confetti, Taylor Swift. Oh, and he was like, of course she put confetti in here. Anyway, it's been a week. Happy Taylor Swift week to all that celebrate. Namaste.
Did you get all the confetti cleaned up? Because that's a nightmare.
Well, 100%. I was like, you keep that. Do not throw that confetti away. Because I didn't get it on video. Yeah, it's a horror show that I did not get it on video. I didn't like film him opening this thing because I was making dinner. And it was so funny. And I screamed so loud that he was embarrassed for the neighbors. He was like, they're going to think I beat you, that this is violence. It was so bad.
I'm
also
not over
great.
The confetti. Wait, why are you holding on to the confetti? What's the multi-use purpose for the confetti?
Well, it's irrational. Just leave me be. I don't know. I just wanted to like keep it. It just made me laugh. And I will say that this is the first piece of Taylor Swift merch I've ever purchased. So I am a huge
wow.
Swiftie, but I've never gone insane. This is the first time I've had a record player as an adult. So I was like, no, I want the vinyl to this album. So it's the first piece of merch. So I had no idea that there was going to be like a confetti situation.
Well, congratulations. You deserved the confetti situation and the party that was receiving your Taylor Swift vinyl. So congratulations to you.
Huge week. Huge week. Huge.
So this morning, you know, I was up kind of early hanging out with Russell, going on a little walk, and I saw that there was an episode of podcast that I was kind of anticipating, so I listened to it, and the interview was so moving and relatable and thoughtful, and it made me think about everything that we do and why we do it, and amplifying patient voices and giving credence to the patient experience, and trying to get that out there for to be more influential as patients and patient advocates. There's an artist named Hertz Nazir, and you may have seen me in videos wearing a black zip-up hoodie with, you know, different like molecules and stuff on it, and that's one of Hertz's designs on that hoodie. Hertz has sickle cell disease and is a Haitian-born artist who has spent most of his life in the United States. And I have to say, and Dr. Z on Cheat Codes, I'm speaking about, this was on Cheat Codes, and Dr. Z said, you know, just the way he even speaks about sickle cell disease is art. And I couldn't summarize the 50-minute interview better than that. The way the man speaks about his experience with sickle cell disease is art.
There are things out there that can make your life better if you can only hold on and seek for those things. And that's what hope is to me, is that even though you may think everybody's against you or this thing is going to take you out, there are still ways you can win. There are still opportunities to win. And there are still people out here who are fighting every day just to make sure that you have those opportunities. So I just feel like, you know, if we can only become one of those people for somebody else, it's worth it to fight on another day.
And then on Monday of this week, a buddy of mine named Preston Bowling, who I met 5, 6, 7 years ago when he was a teenager, he is one of the guests on Journeys this week, and he shared his story of being undiagnosed for quite a long time. And, you know, one of these stories where it's endless bleeding and nosebleeds and this and that and this doctor. And he tells a story about being held down by this one doctor and his parents as they were trying to drain his hip. And it just was so like, wow. But one quote that he shared that got me a little choked up, to be honest, was a huge part of who I am today is how I was forced to grow up. And I think that's a very relatable idea for not just people with a bleeding disorder, but people who faced some sort of major adversity as a child. And as an adult, I think it's easy to look back and understand there are some moments that are entirely influential and some experiences that do alter the course of everything else. Fortunately, when Preston's younger brother was born, well, unfortunately, he had to go through a period of 5 surgeries in 2 weeks because he just kept bleeding and they couldn't figure it out. And that situation was so dire that they did eventually test for hemophilia, found he had hemophilia, and that's what led to Preston getting his diagnosis. But, you know, he talked about like everything as a kid that he wanted to do, he couldn't, you know, and like I was literally last night talking to somebody about how I still carry with me at my age now as a full adult, the kid who was told no a lot. And that's just an ever present for me. That's an ever present part of how I, who I am that I have to contend with, because it's not always helpful. Yeah. But yeah, I just, Amy off the bat wanted to share, like, these are two different, very different patient stories. One from Hertz, one from Preston on two very different podcasts, but both of them just make so clear the importance of appreciating the patient experience and how wide-ranging those experiences can be.
Mm-hmm. And I also, I mean, to gather, I kept thinking how important it is to share your story and who you might be inspiring, or just hearing your own voice through someone else's words, and the ability to be seen in that way. You know, it feels, it's discombobulated, obviously, because you're not, you know, speaking with someone personally, but to feel seen that you're not alone, it's not a lonely experience. There are other experiences, and how important words are, story is. It's really lovely. And I know, here in this pandemic era, I know there's fatigue. There's probably podcast fatigue, story fatigue, education fatigue, awareness fatigue, politics fatigue.
2020 fatigue.
Just fatigue in general. And just to hear that possibility, that's great. I'm so happy you shared with us. I am going to 100% run out and listen to those stories, worthy stories. And that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So yeah, cheat codes and journeys from this week. There'll be links in the program notes, bloodstreammedia.com, for links to all episodes of all of our shows. But moving along now to our second topic, which is the upcoming COVID vaccine. So this is like happening in real time. So again, we're recording on Tuesday. By the time this comes out, there might be some new information. But I think it's safe to say at this point, Amy, that a vaccine is imminent. We seem to be on the logistics phase of who's getting them, when and how, and what that timeline is going to look like. One thing that's come up, and I've seen it come up a lot on social media, is there anything that we as people with bleeding disorders need to be aware of with the vaccine? And thus far, from everything I've gathered, the short answer, again, not a doctor, the short answer is no. Yes, there's infusion site stuff and like kind of typical, if you get any kind of needle in the arm vaccine, you may have some, but nothing particular to COVID, except that there are COVID-19 vaccines that are being studied. I don't believe any of these are in human clinical trials yet, but that use the adeno-associated virus, or AAV. Why is that relevant? Well, if you've listened to Amy and I talk about this, or if you listen to the It's in the Genes podcast, you know that the AAV virus is the vector being used by the forms of gene therapy most commonly being explored for hemophilia A and B. So if you were someone who were to get a COVID-19 vaccine that was leveraging one of these AAV vectors, it would make you ineligible to receive gene therapy for hemophilia that was using one of those AAV vectors. Again, this is not the current vaccines that are being discussed. This is not what's imminently coming out. But just as time goes by, and just that you know this in your head, because it's a fair question for people to ask, wait, should I be concerned to someone with hemophilia about a vaccine? Just know that down the road, if you hear about an AAV vaccine and you're someone who's interested in gene therapy, that is not the vaccine for you. And that's kind of it. That's kind of the main point that I wanted to hit on with regard to the COVID vaccine.
That's just a great point. And I think it highlights the point too, to be mindful of this. You know, I think a lot of people are just like, well, I'm just going to take the vaccine if they say it's fine, just like a flu vaccine. Just ask, you know, just ask and get as much information as possible. But it makes sense that AAV, that they're doing research with it. It's such a benign vector. So it makes sense that someone's doing work on it, and it might not come to fruition. It might not need to come to fruition. These might, you know, the vaccines that are out now might suffice. But anyway, good to know. And thank you, PJL.
And to that point too, hey, you're welcome, AB. But it's also good for us to keep in mind going forward. There may be other vaccines for stuff that we don't even know about yet that leverage this, the AAV gene therapy science. So to Amy's point, it's just good for us to be aware, ask the questions. Anytime we're putting anything in our bodies, we should be asking these questions.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
At least in the short term, when it comes to COVID, there's no big sweat there. So a sigh of relief. Okay, and then our final topic before we get to Bill and Nathan, the returning champion. Hemophilia gene therapy. Gene therapy is robust scientific inquiry, the missing factor. If you're wondering about an experience of deja vu, maybe you're experiencing that, but you have heard us talk about this before. You've heard that title on this podcast before. There was an article published 6 weeks ago, something like that, 2 months ago, time is a flat circle, by the same people who were present in this panel on the same topic, gene therapy, and specifically asking the question, is robust scientific inquiry the missing factor, which implies maybe robust scientific inquiry isn't currently taking place. We'll put a link to that article in the program notes. And the WFH, they did say that sometime this week, the video from the live stream of the panel would be available. At the time that we're recording, I couldn't find it this morning, so it's not up yet. But if you're interested when you're listening to this, do poke around the WFH. Maybe you can find it. But
and maybe we can post it on Twitter. You can find us on Twitter, y'all.
Yeah, that's a good point. We'll post maybe it on like, Twitter and Facebook when it goes live. I think the most important point that I took away from this, and it's a great panel, Brian O'Mahony, Glenn Pierce, Mark Skinner, Radoslaw Kaczmarek. I've heard him speak numerous times. I'm never going to know how to pronounce his name correctly. I stink at Polish. And it was hosted by David Page from the Canadian Hemophilia Society. You know, the biggest thing that I took away, Glenn was adamant about the importance for transparency and really robust questions that we ask robust questions about the safety, the efficacy, the durability. When we see variants, why? What might it be caused by? You know, he came back to a point, I've heard him say this before too, we have extraordinary therapies available to us right now. Every patient who's not in a clinical trial who has hemophilia is not taking a gene therapy medication currently, and you know, I feel like I'm doing pretty good. So if we have these great options, we need to be very careful about the steps we take on something brand new, especially, you know, he had this little chart that he posted that was like one of those grids where it's knowns and unknowns and knowns and unknowns. And I've heard the expression the known unknowns, and that's a concept that I'm a fan of, actually. Life is full of known unknowns. We know there's things we don't know. But there's also things we don't know we don't know. The unknown unknowns, as it were. And Glenn spoke about those too. And for him, gene therapy really needs to deliver on the promise of it providing a cure for hemophilia. When the panelists were at some point asked, what if you had to redose every X number of years, you know, for each of you, what's kind of the threshold whereby gene therapy would feel like a viable option? And people had different answers. It's a personal question. I was particularly taken by Glenn's response, which was, it should be a cure. We're talking about a cure. We have great life-sustaining medications available. We should be pushing this until it is a cure. And I thought that was important. Brian O'Mahony, who we also talked about last week as being one of the hemophilia B patients profiled in a recent article in the Irish Times, I think it was, he made a great point when he pointed out that this is the first time we have an irreversible therapy for hemophilia. And we talk about shared decision-making, patients and doctors speaking together about what is that individual's optimized regimen. But the need for shared decision-making around something that is irreversible, it probably has never been higher. So when considering a clinical trial, making sure the expectations are really well understood in order to avoid, and I'm quoting here, treatment remorse. So I thought that was also an excellent point. And yeah, the whole thing wrapped up with this key message that I'll leave it with this. This is an urgent reminder while gene therapy is under clinical investigation. We need more transparency from all those pursuing clinical trials, including meaningful research on the unanswered questions around safety, variability, and durability of response. Only in this environment can we have confidence in this technology. I mean, that's pretty well articulated, and I think that first sentence is really is key. While gene therapy is under clinical investigation, this is the time. This is the time to study it, to really get to know this science as intimately as we can in order to, as said here, instill confidence that this is, in fact, a viable treatment option.
You know, listening to you talk, I think my first takeaway is to commend the folks that have entered trials and how just to kind of remark on their courage and their, you know, heading into the unknown to do that, you know, for the sake of the rest of us as we sit back and try to make some decisions. I think it's so important, and the clinical trial process, the scientific process, won't happen without people willing to do that. So just a hats off to the people that are crushing it and being able to share their story. And that brings me to the second takeaway is, and we say this all the time, of like gathering as much information as you can. But I think one thing that we haven't really said is, you know, we're especially people that listen to this podcast, you know, you're in it. We know the players, we know the people that have the information. There's access to those people. Dr. Pipe, Glenn, you know, some of these people that we know, find the person that you trust and kind of deep dive into that personal relationship, but I think also make sure that the information you surround yourself with is also diverse. I think find the different point of view, understand that different point of view, and then also we have access to people that are going through this trial. Brian, we just spoke about last week. Brian's going through it. He mentioned it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Now we can follow Brian. We've had Luke on. Luke. Mm-hmm. Has been able to talk about his experience, and that is such a wealth of information, the people that are going through it. And I guess that was just a little bit of my takeaway. You know, I think from a scientific community standpoint, that transparency is really important. But for the people on the ground, you know, making these decisions about their own body and their own livelihood and their own, you know, choice of how they're going to go through their life, you know, really be mindful of the circle that you get to create for the opinions that you get to create, and make sure there is, make sure you get both sides.
So again, the name of both the article that was published and the webinar that will be available through the WFH, Gene Therapy is Robust Scientific Inquiry, the Missing Factor. And thank you. You know, we mentioned this previously, but I should remind people now, the names I mentioned earlier of the panelists, they're also all men who were born with hemophilia. And I have to say born with hemophilia because Glenn, who had a liver transplant, no longer has hemophilia because he had a liver transplant. So, and if you didn't know that, the factory protein is produced in the liver, you get a liver transplant, boom, you have to, you know, deal with that the rest of your life, but you no longer have hemophilia. So born with hemophilia is an important distinction, but that's enough for that. Follow up on that if you are interested. But now let us transition into our conversation with Bill and Nathan about state level advocacy. A few weeks ago, we talked with Nathan and Joanna about federal advocacy in Washington Days, which I just registered for, by the way, first week of March. Well, email just came around, so I was like, ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba, and I registered. That's how I register. I go, ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba, and it happens that way. But now we want to talk about state level advocacy. What's the big differences between state and federal? Where are their unique challenges on the state level? Some victories that have occurred on the state level, and these are two experts. So let's get to it.
Patrick and I are joined with two members of the policy team at the National Hemophilia Foundation. Nathan Schaefer is the Vice President of Public Policy, and Bill Roby is here. He is the Government Relations Specialist at the National Hemophilia Foundation. Nathan, welcome back, and Bill, welcome to the podcast. We're so excited that you guys are here.
Thanks for joining us, guys.
You bet. And we have good news to share. Bill is now actually the senior manager of government relations for NHF. Brand new title to be implemented January 1. Congrats. Well deserved.
Thank
Bill,
you.
You're a senior.
Yes, I'm a senior.
Sorry. That was me. That was a dig. I'm sorry. That's a dig. I'm sorry. Everybody, we're friends. We were old friends. Oh, that's terrible. It's terrible. I feel terrible. Nathan, we know about your background. If you have not heard about Nathan's background, it is fascinating, and we hope that you go back and listen to that federal policy episode. But Bill, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in state politics and what brought you to NHF, the bleeding disorders community.
So I've been involved. I've been working in government relations since 1991, where I started at the federal level in Washington, D.C. And then through successive jobs, I left D.C. after a number of years and went to work at state level in Pennsylvania. Then I went to work at a local level in Atlanta, Georgia, and then eventually ended up doing local government relations work in Oregon before I came to work for NHF. And so this is the first time I did state government relations again in Pennsylvania for about 4 years. So it was something I was familiar with. And so I've been with NHF now since 2015.
That's great. What are your impressions of the bleeding disorder community?
It's been great. I really appreciate the passion of the people that are involved. I like working for the families. The hardest part of this whole shutdown for me is I don't get to travel. Because my favorite part of the job is going to chapter events and meeting with people, because otherwise I'm doing this. I'm with all these people, just me in my office. So I really miss that. And I appreciate the fact that people get really engaged in advocacy and are very supportive of our work.
Bill, I'm curious, in addition to missing that, has any part of your work been made harder as a result of the pandemic and not being able to be with people in person and attending chapter events, as you just mentioned?
Yeah, I prefer if I'm meeting with government officials, just not only simply missing being in person with our community members, but not sitting across the table from a legislator or an agency official where you can simply, it's a different environment than doing a Zoom call. It's much more intimate. I think you can have more give and take, a more collaborative, congenial discussion than you can when you're doing it electronically. That's my sense.
So to zoom out big picture, to kind of talk about this stuff, we talked pretty in depth several weeks ago about federal policy, about, you know, where we are kind of headed into after the election. From a national organizational standpoint, from a agenda perspective, why is it so important to focus on state issues as well as federal issues?
Well, I'll tackle that. I'm going to get all Schoolhouse Rock on you here, Amy.
Yes, yes.
So it's really, in my perspective, it's the constitutional design of the country. I mean, the founding fathers set up a system that really limited the powers of the federal government and gave most authority to the states. It has certainly changed a lot in 200 odd years. The federal government certainly has more power than it originally had. However, states still retain significant powers over commerce and other aspects of life. And even though healthcare, I would say in the last 50 years, there's a lot more federal involvement with Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act in healthcare, states still have a lot of power, especially over regulating the insurance market. So states are still very important and still retain a lot of power over commerce and therefore healthcare.
I would say too, from a patient advocacy perspective, I can't tell you how many people come to Washington Days and they're like, oh, this was just like the Lansing Days experience. Like, it's just a lot longer of a walk in between the meetings. But I think a lot of our advocates can get more comfortable talking with elected officials at the state and local level. And I think that confidence can translate to their ability to be an effective advocate with the same elected officials at the state and local levels, but also with federal elected officials, because our marching orders are really the same. Go in, tell your story, make it compelling, make sure they understand you're a resource to the office in the event that they've got questions about bleeding disorders down the road. And for a lot of advocates who haven't engaged in legislative advocacy, which can be intimidating if you haven't done it a few times, but when you're able to do it at the state level, I think it is still intimidating, let's be honest, but I think less so than when you're in Washington, D.C. So I think there is a combination of improving our advocates' comfort and confidence that they can be advocates at the state level as well as the federal level. It's sort of like mini Washington Days at every state capital where we have one of these advocacy days. And we don't have them in all 50 states. We don't have chapters in all 50 states. But I think last year in 2019, which is the most valid year of comparison because 2020 has been complicated for all kinds of reasons. But in 2019, we did state advocacy days at 30 state capitals. Recognizing we don't have chapters in all 50 states, I'm pretty proud of that figure.
One follow-up to a point, Bill, that you made about the way the limitations of the federal government were intentionally set up. When we think about access, I guess that's what comes to mind for me. When I think about patient access and how to actually reach optimal, personalized, individualized healthcare, it feels as though on a state-by-state level, it's fighting a lot of different fights, each of which have slightly different parameters. Whereas in theory, if we could tackle it from a federal level, then it's one big initiative. But unfortunately, the system doesn't seem like it's designed that way. Can you speak to this idea of access challenges and how we best message and communicate as a national organization when, to your point, each state has its own field of play, so to speak?
Yeah, sure. And again, that was the intention of the founding fathers, right? 50 different laboratories of democracy. And so it's kind of it's a knife that cuts both ways. In some cases, and this is true, I've worked for a number of different industries. In some cases, you like centralized power. In other cases, you don't. One of the challenges, one of the principal challenges we have is dealing with this issue, which I'm sure we'll get into later, of copay accumulators. Well, the most egregious problems we have with that are with health insurance plans that are regulated at the federal level, not at the state level. We've had success limiting those programs in at least five states with legislation. But none of those touch federally regulated employer-provided healthcare plans. And that's a very tough one to do because of the nature of the law you have to amend. And when you're dealing with things at the federal level, you're dealing with 320 million voters in the country or citizens of the country trying to change laws. So DC moves very slowly because of that. The states move a little bit quicker. So if we have, by the same reason, if you have a problem at the state level, maybe it's easier to fix it, but maybe you only fix it in one state instead of 50. So it's the way I look at it, it really depends on the issue as to whether there's a benefit or a cost of centralizing things or dispersing things. We've seen in some cases legislation move really quickly that we've wanted at the state level, but it's also easier for our opponents to block it. But frankly, dealing with the one issue we have with copay accumulators at the federal level is an incredible challenge because of the monolithic and enormous nature of the federal government and all the constituents that play into that.
You know, using the accumulator issue as a example, explain a little bit that whole regulation of your insurance plan, of how you can figure that out, why it's so important to know who regulates your personal insurance plan, why it's so convoluted, why if, you know, you have a bill that's passed, say, in Rhode Island, it doesn't necessarily trickle down to every plan, every person in Rhode Island. Explain that a little bit. Bill, which I know is a big question.
Well, I'll get Marla Feinstein on the phone and we can solve this like that. it's so this is where the Affordable Care Act changed some things. The Affordable Care Act did set a sort of federal standard for health insurance plans. Again, there are some exceptions to that, but generally, while the states regulate the insurance market, they still have to be in compliance with the Affordable Care Act and to offer a plan in the marketplace. So that changed a lot of things and set a sort of a floor, if you will, or a baseline for individual or small group health plans that certainly helped things for us. But as you point out, they're still within that. States can still, they have some flexibility. So some states, we've been successful at getting language, limiting consumers' out-of-pocket expenses. We've done it on the regulation side, working with the state, and Colorado is one of those. And in other cases, we've had to do it legislatively. So that's the interesting thing about the state is, like the federal government, sometimes you can't get what you want to get done through the state legislature, which is always a challenge, but you can have success working with the state insurance commission, the regulatory body at the state level. So it kind of depends, you know, whether you have a favorable legislature or you have a favorable governor's office. But again, if you change things in Rhode Island, you only change things in Rhode Island, you don't change it in Massachusetts, which makes that a challenge. But again, I think at state government level, it's a little bit more accessible certainly than it is to do things at the federal level. That's a very general description of, you know, the insurance markets and who regulates what.
I agree with that state advocacy, at least from my experience, it felt more accessible. Like I was able to build relationships by just going to several meetings a year, learning the people in the room, you know, everyone's accounted for in a way. There's a representative from everybody, the governor's office, DOI, you know, all of these places, and you can figure out who's making the decisions, who's in the room, and then tackle it that way, at least from a state perspective. I agree with you.
I was on a town hall today, and there was specialists talking about Ohio. And the lobbyist was mentioning they have term limits in Ohio. You can only serve a maximum of 8 consecutive years or 2 terms. They talked about how important, and how influential advocates were, because legislators are only in there for 8 years and they can't possibly know it all. And so advocates generally set the agenda in Ohio because of that reason.
That's
Bill,
really
I'm not
interesting.
Gonna lie. I think that's our quote. I just want to say that. I think that's like our quote that we're going to use forever. Bill just nailed it.
Well, you know, I do kind of want to pause on that because I think term limits are very good for a host of reasons, none of which I've ever included. I've never included it makes advocates more powerful. I've never kind of thought that through. But if you don't have that same kind of institutionalist sitting in the chair, so to speak, then you need the person walking through the door who's here to talk to you about said thing to be coming in with that institutional expertise. So that's, yeah. I've never thought about that, but that actually seems kind of important to highlight.
So I have many thoughts on term limits, and I'll try and keep them concise. But Bill mentioned Ohio, which is my home state, and he's right. You can only serve 8 years consecutively. The vast majority of legislators in Ohio, though, will bounce House, Senate. Like, they can go back and forth. So they're there for a long time. However, I can tell you, when I started, and as Amy alluded to in the last podcast, I went through my background, which is really in HIV and AIDS public policy and advocacy. Having met with legislators in Ohio for a number of years earlier in my career, when you're going in to talk about HIV and there have been term limits, so there's always new elected officials, they don't know anything. You have to start from less than 101. With bleeding disorders, it's even more complicated than just HIV. So there is benefit in having a legislator who has a history with the community that can learn over time what are the nuanced considerations of what it's like to care for a rare disease. By contrast, in New York State, we don't have term limits. There are people who have been serving in the New York State Assembly and Senate since the 70s. And I'll give you a quick example of how that can be incredibly problematic. New York State in the early 1980s banned surrogacy, where someone can have a baby and then give it to intended parents. And laws have changed significantly since the early 80s, but there was a terrible case back then. And the New York State and New Jersey actually banned in law the practice of surrogacy. That practice retained up until 2020. And the only reason it passed and changed this year is because the chair of the Judiciary Committee, who had been there since the 1970s, got COVID and couldn't be in Albany when they were making decisions about the law. She single-handedly held up the policy change despite decades of medical advancements and research. But when people are stalwarts and they have dogmatic opinions and there aren't term limits, sometimes you can't get around them. So I'm not here to advocate right. for term limits or against. I'm just giving some context for pros and cons of either approach. It's really complicated. And keep in mind, it varies significantly across all 50 states.
Appreciate that. Kind of point counterpoint, the pros and the cons to that kind of a legacy. Wow, that's a great example, an unfortunate one. So we touched on copay accumulator programs, but I also want to identify one or two other healthcare initiatives that states in particular have been challenged by in recent years. Is there another example of something that's been pretty top of mind when we think about state advocacy within bleeding disorders in the last few years?
Sure. I would say our issues fall into two general buckets. One, which includes copay accumulator, is patient out-of-pocket expenses. There's different forms of legislation around that. Again, some of it we've done on the regulatory side, some legislatively. So that deals with simply how much you're going to pay or what kind of an obstacle cost is to patients. The other area is very broadly called utilization management. And this is basically the types of controls or restrictions that commercial health plans, as well as public payers like Medicaid, put in place. There's sort of various hurdles or barriers you have to go through to access the medication you want. And generally speaking, they're well-intended, they're cost control measures. And if you have the kind of condition, or for most people that can use generics, then some of those probably are not an obstacle. Medication that I use is almost always available as a generic. But if you have a bleeding disorder and you're being subjected to utilization management, and there are really no cheaper forms of factor or non-factor products, then utilization management can be a real problem because you can't quite get to the medication that your doctor has determined what's best for you. There's things like step therapy, where basically your insurance company decides the medication you're going to get, not your doctor, or non-medical switching, where a formulary can change in the middle of the year. In the case of prior authorizations, which are common now, even in Medicaid, you've got to have a prior authorization simply to get your medicine. And then maybe every 90 days you have to update it. So there's a lot of sort of hoops like that that keep people from accessing their medication. Formulary kind of management is another one I think is probably separate from utilization management. Formularies are on the public payer side, a preferred drug list. Some drugs are easier to get to than others. Those are generally the areas that we find ourselves advocating on to make sure our patients can get the therapies they need.
In your opinion, have you seen HTC staff, social workers, and nurses swoop in and mask some of those issues that are happening? They just deal with the insurance companies and just keep fighting, calling, and the patient is unaware that step therapy is actually happening. Have you run into that in terms of advocate work?
I absolutely believe that's the case in most situations. I don't know, because we work a lot with social workers. Right. Our insurance and reimbursement conference is a great forum for us to learn from social workers and for them to hear from us. And I think you're absolutely right, Amy. I think the social workers, they are the shock troops. They're on the front lines for our patients, making sure they get their medication. And patients probably don't see that. And so, which can make it tough for us to get patient stories, which is why we try to work so closely with the treatment centers to get those stories that we're otherwise missing.
Right. You touched on Medicaid a little bit. I wondered if we could go back and kind of expand the work that you guys do with advocates and with your chapter leaders on Medicaid. How are state leaders involved on a grassroots level when it comes to Medicaid in particular?
Well, working with Medicaid has been a priority for NHF for about, I would say, at least the last 2 years, because we started seeing states adopt preferred, starting to manage clotting factor and other bleeding disorders products on a preferred drug list, which is simply a public version of a formulary. And so we've invested in it, and consequently, we've also tried to encourage chapters to do that as well. And so chapters are doing that. I've participated with several of my chapters and states that I cover in meetings with the state Medicaid agency simply to educate them about bleeding disorders, because we know our patients are disproportionately costly, but they're also a very small slice of the overall patient population. So our numbers are outliers for the bean counters with the state agencies. But we need to explain why. We need to be in the understanding so our patients can still get their medication. We don't want states putting our products on a preferred drug list and making it more difficult for our patients to get them. So we do try to educate that, and we collaborate with the state chapters in that effort.
I wanted to make a couple of comments about preferred drug list in particular, because this is a trend that we've now seen, I think, in 18 states, if you include the District of Columbia, which just did this last week. So this is a cost utilization technique where Medicaid offices will say, we're going to make these products preferred and these products non-preferred. And our response is, we understand that our condition is very costly. So that is not an unreasonable approach. However, if that interferes with a physician's ability to get a patient onto whatever product the patient requires, what does that process look like? And it varies significantly everywhere this happens. But our job as advocates is to say, well, how do we get to the non-preferred products And how are you educating all of the providers in the state about what that means for patient access to those non-preferred products? What typically happens when these Medicaid offices consider implementing a preferred drug list, a PDL, is there will be a committee meeting. It's a pharmacy and therapeutics committee in most states. So you'll hear us say, your P&T committee is meeting and they're considering implementing a PDL for hemophilia products. Often, most of the time, that includes an opportunity for patients to go and provide testimony about why access to all these products is so important. Usually you have to register about 2 weeks in advance, and you need to provide your testimony, and it needs to be limited to 3 to 4 minutes. And this is where we partner with chapter leaders and state advocates, where we say, there's an opportunity for patient testimony. Who do you have that can be a great advocate? And we've had chapter leaders go and testify at these P&T committee meetings, but more importantly, we've had volunteer advocates from many states go and do so. And keep in mind, I got a question once from somebody in the New England region that was like, I don't know if I should go and be an advocate because my family's not covered by Medicaid. And I said, well, you can still talk about the importance of community access. And let's keep in mind, all of us might find ourselves in a position where we would need to rely upon Medicaid. So that doesn't mean you can't be an excellent advocate on behalf of those who require access to the Medicaid services. And finally, I will tell you, at a conference years ago in the state of Mississippi, they were implementing a PDL and we were giving them hell. Like, no, can't do this, can't do this. And then I went to a meeting of Medicaid officials and ended up randomly sitting down face to face with the deputy director of the Medicaid office. And she's like, oh, you're from the Hemophilia Foundation. Why are your patients so special? And it gave us an opportunity to explain the complexity and the nuances and the difficulties of treating patients with hemophilia and other bleeding disorders and the potential development of inhibitors. And we went through this, it was a 10-minute conversation, but I didn't have a chance to sit down with her other than like sending letters every month over the past year when they were considering implementing restrictions on access. So oftentimes we don't necessarily have the opportunity to have these kinds of conversations to explain why bleeding disorders are just so unique. All the more reason why, if your chapter calls and says they need a patient advocate to go and testify in front of the Medicaid committee, we need your help. We really do. This is sort of all hands on deck with educating these officials. We're just more complicated than most conditions.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever told you this, but the one time that I testified in front of our Medicaid committee, it was in a cafeteria and it had like this like stench of stuff. It was like lunch. It was like seventh grade lunch. And it was just, it felt like 70s, like linoleum. And I remember being like, ugh, this is democracy. And all my friends got to, you know, like testify in these cool rooms or these buildings, or these very fancy tables and carpet and things. And mine was in a cafeteria. It was, and I didn't realize it was such a trigger until you told that story, Nathan. And here we go.
I remember on one of my first trips overseas for hemophilia-related stuff with the WFH that one of the leaders on that trip made the point that we were in Africa and he was saying, you know, if there's a success in country X and we're able to get emergency funding for some stock of factor to be used in the case of emergencies and to start the process of the government wrapping their head around hemophilia, it can help neighboring countries and states start to think and feel differently because they see like, oh, what's going on over here? And there's a little bit of a competitiveness. There's a little bit of a natural curiosity. Leaders speak to each other. And I thought that makes a lot of sense just on a basic human level. I'm curious within the United States, from a state advocacy point of view, do we see that at all? A success in one state maybe leads neighboring states or other states to change their point of view on something?
That's a great question.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have, in addition to the fact that state legislators and state agency officials have their own trade associations, there's the National Conference of State Legislatures. There are associations. I've seen people on calls, the National Association of State Budget Officers. And so they're all talking amongst themselves. Everybody is. It's down to the local government level as well. I can testify to that. So that any ideas, in fact, We're a member of the SAIM coalition, SAIM, which stands for the State Access to Innovative Medicine. It's a national coalition of patient advocacy groups. And one of the things the coalition did is basically we purchased a level of membership in NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures, which allows the coalition to have a booth at their trade show. And if you're at a certain tier of membership, you can speak at roundtables, you can propose policies to different committees. So, and I'm sure insurance companies are doing this and pharmaceutical companies are doing this. So at that level, definitely ideas spread among legislators, but it also spreads among advocates and everybody else in the process. If insurance companies see you don't think they've seen where these copay accumulator bills have been adopted and are game planning for how to stop that elsewhere. So we have to then adjust. It's the great chess game of advocacy.
I would give an example too from the New England area where I work with all of the states there. And the best way that I can explain access to care in New England in the various states is that it's porous. Like people from Vermont and New Hampshire will drive to Boston to go to the hemophilia treatment center. And it's not that far of a drive. They're small states. They're densely populated, but they're small states. Maine was the first state ever to implement one of these Medicaid preferred drug lists like we talked about. Well, guess what? Now there's one in Vermont and Connecticut. One of the other states in a different part of the region, the country, where a PDL was implemented was Georgia. Well, guess what? Now there's PDLs in Louisiana and Mississippi. So the Medicaid directors know one another, particularly those that are regional. So yes, Patrick, to your question, if one state does something, does another state take notice, especially if it's a cost savings? Absolutely. Absolutely. And frankly, I think for some policymakers, they can use a decision by a neighboring state as rationale for why they might be implementing some kind of a cost containment measure in that state. So yes, policy changes that happen in one state, the nearby state is absolutely going to take notice.
And it goes the other way. When I was, when we were working on copay numbers, you know, California wrote a bill and got a bill through and we were like, oh, stole the language and, you know, just like, you know, reused it. When I was on the advisory board at our exchange, our insurance exchange, we had Covered California, you know, some of their higher ups and thought leaders on the phone all the time in terms of what they did with certain things. So it goes the other way as well.
It does. And it's not, it can be advantageous from an advocacy perspective. So let me give you an example. One of the other things that we've been prioritizing in recent years is the establishment or the reestablishment of rare disease councils, which are advisory committees that can sort of inform a state's the way that they structure healthcare or legislation policies, you name it. This year in West Virginia, where they used to have a rare disease council, they were able to get it approved to be reestablished. And that is great. And our chapter ED has played a very decisive role in that action. In South Carolina, they have legislation to establish the first ever rare disease council. So what we're able to do from the NHS state policy team is say, yo, you, the two EDs in West Virginia, South Carolina, you need to compare notes because I don't know what message you used and what worked and what didn't work, but like whatever knowledge you have about that campaign should benefit other community members in other states. So we're able to sort of pull people together and just say, like, here's an example, like you gave the California example, why reinvent the wheel? Take the language and implement it for your state. So that's part of our job is to just make community connections, if you will.
You know, you've mentioned individual states, but I'd love to hear like some victories that you've had with states and the uniqueness of each state's legislature, which was something that, I mean, I feel, you know, I have a theater degree, so, you know, I didn't know anything anyway, but everybody is so unique and different. So tell me a little bit about that, about the unique victories of some of our states.
Yeah, well, and that uniqueness leads to unique victories when you can have them. I mean, we have states, there are four states in the country that only meet every other year. And even then they only meet for like 2 or 3 months. So it's your window of opportunity is very narrow. So, but doesn't mean you're not working that entire time to accomplish something. I would say the most noteworthy victories in recent times have to do with the copay accumulator adjuster bills. I think we went from zero to five states adopting them within an 18-month period. And then some states have participated in coalitions where step therapy legislation has been adopted. I think we're now over the 50% mark. In other words, more than, I think around 25 or slightly more states have some restrictions on step therapy. That's generally been the areas. I consider it victorious for some of our smaller states or our smaller chapters that have actually held a state advocacy day. They've actually mustered up enough people and gone to the state capitol. I've participated. I have, being a Westerner, I have a lot of very large states with very small populations and small chapters. And so it's been very refreshing and gratifying to see some of those states really get behind advocacy and bring people to the state capitol, because that's where it all starts. It's all that relationship building. And so for us, that's, again, that's a significant victory just to get some chapters involved in advocacy.
I would say two things. One, there's a number of states, it's not more than a dozen, but it's probably more than five, that have line items that are specific to either premium assistance or support of the network of hemophilia treatment centers. In one state, Pennsylvania, it's almost $1 million in the annual budget that goes to support the seven hemophilia treatment centers across the state. That is essential that advocates go and defend that funding, because it benefits everyone in the So funding, specific funding for supportive bleeding disorder programs or HTCs is essential and has been a victory for states to even defend that in recent years, because it's been so challenging. The other thing I would point to is Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. And that's in March. And this was a campaign that we really embarked on in 2016. And we got it designated at the federal level, but then we encouraged all of our chapters in the community to try and get either a governor or a state legislature to declare March as Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. And in 2019, again, that's the most recent valid comparison year, we had 25 states declare Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. And that's awesome. And it's a great plaque that chapters can put on their wall and people can be proud about. But that's not really what we're after. What we're after is a connection to a policymaker, be it a governor or a legislator, who can understand the concerns and the plights of the bleeding disorders community. And I'll give you a brief example. In the state of Rhode Island, they pursued a resolution in support of March as Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month a few years ago. And they made a connection with a legislator who said, "You've got a champion in my office. If you ever need anything, please don't be shy." Lo and behold, 6 months down the road, an accumulator bill was introduced in Rhode Island that would have had grave implications for bleeding disorder patients. Like, it was not a good bill. But there was a connection that had been established because they went and pursued this resolution. So they went to a legislator, expressed their concerns, and the bill died like the next day. So don't think about these opportunities as just like a fancy plaque on the wall. What you're trying to do is establish a meaningful connection with an elected official who can make you feel good when they give you this fancy plaque, but ultimately you've got a relationship that can be mutually beneficial down the road.
And I just want to stress that point.
For the plaques, though.
It's so important to build relationships where you have no idea that this particular person, maybe on this particular committee, years down the road, months down the road, might be important. Just like that Rhode Island story. You know, you go in, you make this connection, it's wonderful, and then that person is on a committee that could have implications of something that you, that might affect your family. And that's the beauty of democracy. I love that. Just wanted to...
Well, Amy, you know, to that very point, actually, so, and I think I may have told this story before on the podcast, so apologies, listeners, if I have. But years ago, when Michelle Kim, I think it was her first year as ED in Southern California, and it was my first time going to Washington days, federal days, as a California resident as opposed to a New York resident, and I'd had a nightmare situation with Kaiser, so I came with things to say. And I mentioned both of those points because it was at this Washington days where we met for the first time, each of us, with Adam Schiff and made an impression on him very clearly. Fast forward to 2020, and now Adam Schiff is a household name for anyone who's paid attention to the news over the last few years. This February, when we were in D.C., the last trip I did before the world shut down, sure enough, we met with him. We were talking about the SNF bill this year, and he got it, and he was supportive. At the cafeteria, not there to do a testimony like Amy, but just there to eat food with all of the people at D.C., one of the other state advocates, they waved me over, and they mentioned that they had just come from a meeting with their person, and when they were telling them about the SNF bill, they mentioned that Congressman Schiff voiced that he would support it, and then that person, based on that, said, oh, well, if Adam's supporting it, then I'm in. And it's like, there we go. We've got someone who has a direct relationship with this community, whose star has risen in Congress, and whose voice means a lot. So when that person says, I'm supportive of this thing that's beneficial to the bleeding disorders community, there's a very tangible ripple effect that that has. And that little interaction in the cafeteria just crystallized that for me. So just to reinforce, it might not be someone who right now is a household name, but years from now could be, or they might move into from this office to a bigger office to a bigger office. So relationship building at any stage of the game is just so, so, so important.
That's a great example. And it underscores a lot of what we say about participants going to Washington days that are meeting with new members of Congress. You have no idea where that member of Congress could end up. One of my first political mentors was Congressman Sherrod Brown. And he had only been in Congress for a few years when I first met him. And now he is the senior senator for the state of Ohio. He sits on the Senate Help Committee, which is the healthcare jurisdiction committee. He's incredibly influential, but he wasn't when I met him. I hope he's not listening, but like he grew to he gained more power over time. So like politicians also are around for a long time. I know we talked about term limits, but like people bounce around. Like I could tell you New York City stories about different offices that people seek, but you never know where people are gonna go. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and you said, oh, well, if Adam's on, then I'm on board. Keep in mind, politicians have complicated relationships with other politicians. I've heard people say, oh, that's Amy Board's bill. Oh, absolutely not. I'm not going to sponsor that. I'll vote for it if it comes up for a vote, but I can't put my name on it because I can't stand Amy. And if you ever hear something like that as an advocate, you just smile politely and move on. Don't take the bait, right? If any politician says something disparaging about another politician, don't take the bait. That is not your job. You need to maintain professionalism. You're there to share your story and share the message. But to your point, Patrick, like sometimes people will say like, oh, Bill Robey's on the bill. Like, great. I'll put my name on it. They have complicated relationships and you need to be careful about how you navigate those.
And none of them know about bleeding disorders. They don't know what it's like. And that's what you're there for. It's what you're there for, to tell them what it's been like when your child was born, to tell them what it was like when you went to college and forgot to infuse. You know, it's what you're there for. Going back to how you guys support state-based advocacy, I'd love to hear some of the initiatives that NHF is taking to support some of these advocacy programs at the state and chapter level, and what you're doing with your work on the ground.
Sure. There's all sorts of things we do to support our states. We provide grassroots advocacy training. Anytime we're requested, we're always available for chapters to do that. Typically we'll do that, let's say the night before a group is gonna go to the state capitol. We go in and do a training the night before. It's very much like Washington days. We kind of walk through how it's gonna go. We help states with identifying legislation of concern, putting them in touch with other advocates so they can be part of a coalition, preparing testimony to give, whether it's legislative or with an agency, a Medicaid committee or a state legislative committee, analyzing a bill. I get requests during legislative sessions, probably more than I can answer. Hey, would you take a look at this bill really quick? Are we okay with it? And, you know, you try to turn those around as quickly as possible. Not only policy substance, but sort of style in terms of the volunteer training and advocacy support. We have our state-based advocacy coalition grant program, where we provide grant money every year to states that are either starting up an advocacy program, or in some cases have a more advanced program and are looking to do particular things. So there's all kinds of ways we help the chapters, and really we're there to do whatever the chapters really ask us to do and really want to do. A lot of the requests we get at this time of year when chapters are starting to plan for next year is we give what's called a sort of state of the states or a national update on what's going on in other states and what are we doing at the federal level, where we can talk about what's going on elsewhere, because they're always interested in what other states are doing.
All chapters are now eligible to apply for the State-Based Advocacy Coalition, or SBAC, program. Applications are out now and they're due by December 31st. So if you think your chapter should be engaged in an intensive program like that, we encourage you to encourage them to apply to be part of the program. It is now eligible for all 53 chapters. We used to have 52 chapters, but we added Puerto Rico a few months ago. So we're up to 53. And we're really, really excited about them coming into the fold. So if you want to apply for the SBAC program, let your chapter leaders know. Time's a ticking.
And that's actually a good point. Not every chapter is involved in the program. And in the beginning, it was just a handful. I mean, the state policy team at NHF was small, you know, so it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of capacity. But with COVID and now everything turning virtual, you guys have more ability to kind of grow that capacity since everything will be virtual. So more and more chapters are going to be able to get involved in that program. So if you are listening and would like to have more of a robust state advocacy program, it would be a great thing for you to contact your chapter leaders and say, hey, this grant might be a good idea. It's also money, OMG, money for a nonprofit organization to do good work.
And Amy knows firsthand what it's like to be part of the program, because you were one of our SBACs when you were the chapter ED in Colorado.
I was in the second round of them, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. And
you were.
Oh my gosh, I was a advocacy nerd anyway, but I was 100% just flailing, you know, like an idiot, like just doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And I never connected the importance of the advocates, which seems so dumb. So I was on a bunch of committees, and I was doing all of the like policy access work from that perspective, and you know, bringing in volunteers to help me with that. But I didn't create a state legislative day, and that was the biggest thing that NHF helped me do. And I would not have done that without them. They helped me with bill language. I would send them, you know, a paragraph, and they would, you know, give me, you know, an edited rewrite of what I should, you know, advocate for. So I looked smart in meetings and, you know, like actually, you know, fought for what was needed in terms of our community. It was incredible. And you get that one-on-one interaction with, you know, policy experts at, you know, a national level. So I was on the phone with my folks, with Bill and with Brendan, you know, every other week, really. It was tremendous. And our advocacy program is what it is. I actually just saw that Colorado just had their stakeholder meeting December 1st. So they're still going strong. 20 people were there, they said, which is just incredible.
It was a good crowd. I was in that meeting. I was pleasantly surprised.
So as we come up toward the end of our time, and thank you both for your time today to help make all of this, you know, more accessible to people. And we're very thankful for your coming on. Two big takeaways for me out of this conversation. One, again, the importance of patient testimonials and patient mm-hmm. stories and caregiver testimonials and stories. We know this as a community, but I am reminded constantly of how important it is. So yet again, underscoring the importance of those personal stories. And number two, The ESPAC program with the applications open, the application open window open now but closing soon, is a great way to a point, I think, Amy, you made earlier, that as an individual, you could nudge your chapter to say, hey, have you applied for this state-based advocacy coalition funding? Oh, no, I think the window's open now. And I'll tell you from the work that we do, whether it was Bombardier Blood or Powering Through Bloodstream stuff, I've often gotten an email from either an executive director or a board member responding to someone who came to them and said, I saw a screening or I heard about a thing. Can we bring this to Idaho? Can we bring this to Minnesota or wherever it may be? So the power of one. If you are listening, you have power. So testimonials and nudging your chapter about the state-based advocacy coalition funding. Bill, Nathan, is there a third takeaway that listeners should leave this conversation with in your estimation? Bill, maybe we'll start with you.
I just want to kind of emphasize the point you brought up earlier with your story in the cafeteria, the importance of showing up. If you're not in DC, if you're not in the cafeteria, that moment doesn't happen. I mean, and I see it every year in several, one or two at least, state advocacy days, like I'll cover 8 to 10 a year. There's always those sort of eureka moments when I want to tell people, and I do tell people this, if you're not there, that doesn't happen. So just show up. We will never put you in a position, community member, in a really terrible position where you're set up to fail. We'll never do that. We just need you to be there and we'll help you all the way. But we got to have those patient advocates. And I think everybody that does it really finds it rewarding.
I'll piggyback on that and just say, when you have an opportunity to talk with a policymaker or an elected official, you're there to tell your story. You're not an expert in the legislative process. You don't need to know what committee the bill is going to next. You don't need to know what the P&T committee, what other things they're considering. And in the event that you are ever in a conversation with a policymaker and they ask you a question and you don't know, just say, I don't know. And we will help you figure out the response to that question. Don't ever let the intimidation reserve you from going and showing up. Like Bill said, you're there to share your story. That's it. You don't need to be an expert. You just need to represent the community. So please do. We need you all.
Thank you guys so much for being here on the cusp of our 2021 advocacy season next year. Washington Days is in March this year, I believe. What are the dates again?
March 1st to the 5th.
Yep. 1st through the 5th. They're going to be virtual so we can all get nuts and weird. It's going to be great. So let's all sign up for that. And then State Advocacy Days.
Is that
Days,
the slogan, Get Nuts and Weird? Because I know they were thinking about a few of them. Is Get Nuts and Weird the official Washington Days 2021 slogan? I voted for that one.
That 100%, like, who do I send the email to? Like Dr. Valentino or Michelle? Either? Let's do it. Let's get nuts and weird. Trademarked. Amy Board. Oh, man. Thank you guys again. This is really great. And if you are interested in applying for the ESPAC program, the link is in our program notes. And make sure to check those emails for Washington Dates registration and to bug your chapters about State Advocacy Days. They're going to happen virtually this year. So be connected there. Thank you guys again for coming on. We hope to have you back soon.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Nathan. Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Nathan, for joining Amy and I for that very interesting discussion. And a reminder to listeners out there about the ESPAC program, there is a link in the program notes to find more information. And if your chapter is not already involved, maybe drop somebody a line and encourage them to get involved in the ESPAC program from NHF.
Next week, Patrick and I are going to be joined by Dr. Robert Sidonio. We're very excited.
Ooh. Last year.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to be outdone by hair. No, anyway, last year, Ask the Expert finished the year with two doctors talking about, you know, what were the big takeaways in terms of pipeline and future research for both hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease. They were so popular. We wanted to bring back another physician to just kind of round the year out. What has been the main takeaways? What do the pipelines look like? Have there been any research advances for both hemophilia A, B, and von Willebrand's disease? So join us next week for Dr. Robert Sidonio. It's going to be the best conversation. So much hair, so much man hair. It's going to be great. So make sure you're subscribed to Bloodstream in order to get that episode as soon as it goes live.
Thank you, Amy, for that. Thank you all for listening. And thank you to Takeda for being the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast. And that is all for this episode. Do you have a bleeding disorder or health topic that you would like to hear us discuss? Is there an expert or a guest that you are dying to hear from? You want to inquire about casting opportunities for Bloodstream's narrative and docu-styled podcast series? Just running out of places to send emails? Email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com or connect with Bloodstream Media on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or you can follow Amy or me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Shout out to all the committed LinkedIn users out there. Check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find links and information related to the stories and segments featured on this episode. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I am that other host, Amy Board.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.
Bye.